Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the program, we have a story from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. We also hear from Christopher Jones Cruz. And as always, we end the program with an American story. But first, this report from Mario Ritter.
The South Korean Constitutional Court has removed President Park Geun-hye from office. All 8 members of the court agreed with a National Assembly measure calling for her removal. The 8 worked to rule on the case by Friday before term limits reduced the normally 9-member court to 7 justices. The South Korean Constitution requires at least 6 justices to agree on any impeachment vote by the National Assembly. Chief Justice Park Han-chul was forced to leave the court in January when his term ended. Monday will be the last day of Acting Chief Justice Lee Jung-mi's term. Lee read the ruling from the court's offices in Seoul on Friday. She said Park's acts of violating the Constitution and law are a betrayal of the public trust. The court also criticized Park for being uncooperative and evasive in the investigations. It said she tried to stop the legislature from acting as a check and balance on presidential powers. The court said Park worked with a close friend to pressure large Korean companies to donate nearly $70 million to 2 organizations. Government lawyers had also accused the friend, Choi Soon-sil, of sending some of the money to businesses that she and her friends owned. These violations undermine the rule of law and a representative democracy, said the acting chief justice. Government lawyers studied reports that people close to the president were using her office to raise millions of dollars. Park has repeatedly denied the charges against her. Until the reports of corruption appeared, many South Koreans believed she was a strong and honest leader. 2 people died in protests near the court building after the ruling was announced. Thousands of Park supporters and opponents held competing demonstrations in the area. More than 21,000 police officers were sent there to prevent clashes between the groups. The Constitution requires Acting President and Prime Minister Hwang Kyo-an to set a date for a new presidential election. The vote is to be held within 60 days. In Washington, State Department spokesman Mark Toner released a statement after the court's ruling. It said the United States will continue to work with Prime Minister Hwang for the remainder of his tenure as acting president, and we look forward to a productive relationship with whomsoever the people of South Korea elect to be the next president. The statement said the United States will continue to be a steadfast ally, friend, and partner to South Korea, especially with respect to defending against the threat from North Korea. The South Korean military has been watching North Korea closely since the impeachment vote to guard against North Korean interference in the South's politics. The 64-year-old Park was the country's first female head of state. She is now the first democratically elected South Korean president to be removed from office. In December, 234 members of the 300-seat National Assembly voted to impeach her. Park said any actions she took were to benefit the country. She said she has never personally benefited from her time in office. She apologized publicly 3 times for not knowing that people close to her may have been involved in some wrongdoing. While in office, she could not be tried on criminal charges. Earlier this week, a special prosecutor was named to investigate the charges of corruption. I'm Mario Ritter.
The Mexican government says it is spending $50 million to increase legal aid to migrants who fear the U.S. will send them back to Mexico. The new effort is a response to President Donald Trump's policies on illegal immigration, the Associated Press reported. Last week, all 50 Mexican consulates in the U.S. launched legal assistance centers to form partnerships with nonprofit groups. The consulates will also find lawyers to help those who fear the president's policies. The effort comes as the U.S. and Mexico continue their disagreement over Trump's plans for a border wall. Trump wants Mexico to pay for the wall. Mexico says it will not. In February, the Trump administration also released new rules for aggressively detaining and deporting immigrants. These policies include increasing the number of federal enforcement officers and strengthening cooperation with local law enforcement agencies.
Jose Antonio Zabalgoitia is Miami's Mexican Consul General. Last week, he said that these centers would provide real support for the rights of Mexican migrants. He also said that the consulates will put legal matters first. He said the consulates did not need to seek so much legal support for Mexican people in the past. But now we need to protect them against an eventual deportation, he said. Mexican consulates are forming partnerships with law schools, immigration clinics, and nonprofit groups that take legal action for immigrants. Mexican lawyers who can send legal cases to organizations or clinics work at the centers. The centers are also talking to private law offices interested in donating legal services. Consulates of Mexico and other Central American nations have received numerous requests from migrants. Migrants are concerned about many issues, including what will happen to their children who were born in the U.S.
Zabalgoitia said there has been a sharp increase in requests for official documents and for assistance. He noted that many people are in need of birth records, Mexican passports,
and other documents. Zabolgoitia said he used to sign 2 birth records each week. Recently, he signed 15 in one day. The increasing demand comes from people like Gloria Portillo. She went to the Mexican consulate in Phoenix, Arizona last week to renew her passport. Her visa is no longer current. She is now starting the process of becoming a legal resident. Although she is married to a U.S. citizen, she fears something may stop her from legally staying in the country. Speaking about her friends and family living in the U.S. illegally, she said, "We've been here all of our lives. We have kids, and of course, we're afraid to be deported. Consular offices are becoming very busy. The Philadelphia mission also covers Delaware and southern New Jersey. For that mission, daily appointments at the consulate have doubled to 400 people," Consul General Alicia Kerber Palma said.
Near Boston, Mexican diplomats have been meeting with families at churches and community events to explain complex issues. For example, they explain that without citizenship in both countries, it is difficult to claim U.S.-born children after deportation. About 500,000 Mexican immigrants live in Houston, Texas. Mexican diplomats in Houston said requests for Mexican birth records have risen 50% since Trump announced new measures to limit illegal immigration. Oscar Solis is a first secretary of the Mexican consulate in Houston. He said that feelings toward migrants have become less open and friendly. It's like in wars. They come for one person, and many who are innocent or not really involved end up paying. Davina Siriaco is a 45-year-old woman who cleans houses. She lives in the Miami area. She is gathering all the Mexican documents she would need for her U.S.-born boy to go with her if she is deported. "We live in fear of going back to Mexico, to the violence, the poverty we suffered," said Siriaco.
She migrated with her husband and 2 children 20 years ago from the Mexican state of Guerrero. She gave birth to her 3rd child in Miami. Now, it's just a matter of waiting for that day to come, she said. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
Many Americans think a circus must have elephants, lions, dancing bears, and acrobats. But circuses are changing. In May, after traveling the country for almost 150 years, the large Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus will close. But different kinds of circuses are still successful. They include Cirque du Soleil. It combines music, acrobatics, and storytelling. Adam Woolley operates Circus Now, a nonprofit group that supports efforts by circus performers to combine traditional circus skills like acrobatics, juggling, and the trapeze with storytelling. Woolley says circuses have been changing for many years by increasingly telling stories.
Circus artists have been producing new and incredible circus acts and apparatuses and shows that have an artistic context and theatrical storylines or well-drawn characters. And this has been happening around the world for the past 10, 15 years or so.
One of those circuses is the Racehorse Company from Finland. It was part of the Circus Now Festival in New York this month. Acrobat Rauli Kosonen started the circus with a few other performers 9 years ago.
I think it's really pure art form in the sense that you can really feel the risks. There's a lot of risks, so you can get a lot of adrenaline when you watch it. If there is kind of tricks that make your heart bounce because it's real, they can see that if they make a mistake, they might get hurt. So I guess that's always been why circus is appealing. It reminds us that we are humans.
Kosonen has been injured many times during his performances.
Well, I had 3 operations, then it's part of the job. Sometimes you don't get lucky.
Kendall Riley is one of the founders of New York's only child aerial theater. He says with his group, telling a story or a narrative is even more important than the skills of performing in a circus. He says the skills the performers learn are designed to drive and support the story. In a former factory in Brooklyn, Riley's performers are preparing for the latest show called Asylum. Co-founder Nikki Miller says there is a story, but none of the performers speaks. The story is told through acrobatics, dance, music, and projected images and shadow.
We would describe it as a theater piece that includes a lot of aerial work, dance, some recorded music, some live music, an overhead projection and shadow. So the story is told rather than through dialogue, through the conversation of all of those theatrical vocabularies instead.
Adam Woolley says the only child and racehorse performers simply want to entertain people.
With lots of practice and hard work, we can accomplish the impossible. That's the core idea that everyone in circus believes in and that everyone in circus tries to impart to the audiences, is that I have dedicated my life to this 7 minutes of performance and honed my skill to the place where I'm going to accomplish something in front of you now that you did not think could be done.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Now it's time for our program, American Stories. Here is part one of William Wilson by Edgar Allan Poe.
Let me call myself, for the present, William Wilson. That is not my real name. That name has already been the cause of the horror, of the anger of my family. Have not the winds carried my name with my loss of honor to the ends of the earth? Am I not forever dead to the world, to its honors, to its flowers, to its golden hopes, and the cloud heavy and endless? Does it not hang forever between my hopes and my heaven? Men usually become bad by degrees, but I let all goodness fall from me in a single moment, as if I had dropped a coat. From small acts of darkness I passed in one great step into the blackest evil ever known. Listen, while I tell you of the cause that made this happen. Death is near, and its coming has softened my spirit. I desire, in passing through this dark valley, the understanding of other men. I wish them to believe that I have been in some ways in the power of forces beyond human control. I wish them to find for me in the story I'm about to tell some small fact that proves I could only have done what I did. I would have them agree that what happened to me never happened to other men. Is it not true that no one has ever suffered as I do? Have I not indeed been living in a dream? And am I not now dying from the horror and the unanswered question? The mystery of the wildest dream ever dreamed on earth. I am one of a family well known for their busy minds. As a small child, I showed clearly that I too had the family character. As I became older, it grew more powerful in me. For many reasons, it became a cause of talk among friends, and the hurt it did me was great. I wanted people always to do things my way. I acted like a fool. I let my desires control me. My father and mother, weak in body and mind, could do little to hold me back. When their efforts failed, of course, my will grew stronger. And from then on, my voice in the house was law. At an age when few children are allowed to be free, I was left to be guided by my own desires. I became the master of my own actions. I remember my first school. It was in a large house, about 300 years old, in a small town in England, among a great number of big trees. All of the houses there were very old. In truth, it was a dreamlike and spirit-quieting place, that old town. At this moment I seemed to feel the pleasant coolness under the shade of the trees. I remember the sweetness of the flowers. I hear again with delight, I cannot explain, the deep sound of the church bell each hour breaking the stillness of the day. It gives me pleasure to think about this school, as much pleasure, perhaps, as I am now able to experience. Deep in suffering as I am, suffering only too real, perhaps no one will object if for a short time I forget my troubles and tell a little about this period. Moreover, the period and place are important. It was then and there that I first saw hanging over me that terrible promise of things to come. Ah, let me remember. The house where we boys lived and went to school was, as I have said, old and wide. The grounds about it were large, and there was a high wall around the outside of the whole school. Beyond this wall we went three times in each week. On one day to take short walks in the neighboring fields, and two times on Sunday to go to church. This was the one church in the village, and the head teacher of our school was also the head of the church. With a spirit of deep wonder and of doubt, I used to watch him there. This man with slow step and quiet, thoughtful face, in clothes so different and shining clean. Could this be the same man who, with a hard face and clothes far from clean, stood ready to strike us if we did not follow the rules of the school? Oh, great and terrible question, beyond my small power to answer. I well remember our playground, which was behind the house. There were no trees, and the ground was as hard as stone. In front of the house there was a small garden, but We stepped into this garden only at very special times, such as when we first arrived at school, or when we left it for the last time, or perhaps when father or mother or a friend came to take us away for a few days. But the house! What a delightful old building it was! To me, truly a palace! There was really no end to it. I was not always able to say certainly which of its two floors I happened to be on. From each room to every other there were always three or four steps either up or down. Then the rooms branched into each other, and these branches were too many to count, and often turned and came back upon themselves. Our ideas about the whole great house were not very far different from the thoughts we had about time without end. During the 5 years I was there, I could never have told anyone how to find the little room where I and some 18 or 20 other boys slept. The schoolroom was the largest room in the house, and I couldn't help thinking it was the largest in the world. It was long and low, with pointed windows and heavy wood overhead. In a far corner was the office of our head teacher, Mr. Bransby. This office had a thick door, and we would rather have died than open it when he was not there. Inside the thick walls of this old school, I passed my years from 10 to 15. Yet I always found it interesting. A child's mind does not need the outside world. In the quiet school I found more bright pleasure than I found later as a young man in riches, or as an older man in wrongdoing. Yet I must have been different indeed from most boys. Few men remember much of their early life. My early days stand out as clear and plain as if they'd been cut in gold. In truth, the hotness of my character and my desire to lead and command soon separated me from the others. Slowly I gained control over all who were not greatly older than myself. Over all, except one. This exception was a boy who, though not of my family, had the same name as my own, William Wilson. This boy was the only one who ever dared to say he did not believe all I told him, and who would not follow my commands. This troubled me greatly. I tried to make the others think that I didn't care. The truth was, and I felt afraid of him. I had to fight to appear equal with him, but he easily kept himself equal with me. Yet no one else felt, as I did, that this proved him the better of the two. Indeed, no one else saw the battle going on between us. All his attempts to stop me in what I wanted to do were made when no one else could see or hear us. He did not desire, as I did, to lead the other boys. He seemed only to want to hold me back. Sometimes with wonder, and always without pleasure, I saw that his manner seemed to show a kind of love for me. I did not feel thankful for this. I thought it meant only that he thought himself to be very fine indeed, better than me. Perhaps it was this love he showed for me, added to the fact that we had the same name, and also that we had entered the school on the same day, which made people say that we were brothers. Wilson did not belong to my family, even very distantly. But if we had been brothers, we would have been near to each other indeed, for I learned that we were both born on the 19th of January, 1809. This seemed a strange and wonderful thing.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.